five. Number four, sorry, wisdom is number four. Number three is renunciation. So I'm changing the order a little bit. And I felt going through wisdom first allows for renunciation topic to be presented in a much more easier way. Plus, I was already prepared for wisdom talk. I didn't have enough time for renunciation talk. So mea culpa on that. So the one thing I want you to take net out of this talk is the Buddhist parami of wisdom is not exactly same as the conventionally how we use the word wisdom. There are many similarities, but there are also some differences. Yeah. So keep that in mind as a net takeaway from this talk, because we are conditioned so much when we think about wisdom, what it means. When you think about who the wise person is, I think of Yoda from Star Wars.
Right? <Not yours>.
So, and some people claim the owl is the wise bird, right? We have these associations with us for a long, long, long time. Sometimes we need to decouple that so that we allow for new way to internalize and process what Buddha is trying to say in the definition of wisdom. So effectively, like I said, wisdom comes in number four in our tradition. In Mahayana tradition, they brought down these paramis to six. They call them paramitas, and wisdom is number six. So there's no, the order is inconsistent. So I guess we have some latitude. Right? So one of the things you may have realized already, in Buddhist teachings and Buddhist path, we often use the word cultivate, develop, meditate. These are the active verbs that really define the path. Very, very, very rarely, if not never, I've seen the purpose here is for you to know. Know, and the knowledge hasn't been stressed out as much as the practice of cultivating and developing. There are many, many ways to know, right? But to cultivate and develop requires certain conditions and our effort. And I like the word cultivate because it has that farming connotation to it, which means you plant the seed, you water the seed, and you time it and all the stuff. You still can't predict when it's going to sprout. Right? And what role does the nature play in the sprouting process? There's no model for that. You can have some ballpark idea. So cultivation basically means we are doing our part in our path and let it flow, let the outcome manifest by itself. But keep that in mind as this teaching goes along. And the simplest definition Buddha gave for definition of wisdom is seeing things as they truly are, as it is. Not through the conditioned lens, not we think what it is, not through delusion, fear, preference, or habituality. Right? That's a distinction. The first level of distinction, because conventionally we may think of wisdom means having more knowledge, having more life experience. People have learned from the life experience. They're able to make decisions based on knowledge, experience, and everything else. So those are all, in a conventional way, beautifully defines what wisdom is. But here, Buddha is adding not to rely on our conditionality, beliefs, knowledge, memories, and the way we think, etc., etc. And there is an affiliation between the second parami and wisdom that comes up consistently. And this is one of the most important aspects of the wisdom, as Buddha taught, where there is virtuous conduct, there is wisdom. Where there is wisdom, there is virtuous conduct. So virtuous conduct is implicitly tied to the notion of wisdom. Right? In the normal sense, when we use the word wisdom, we don't necessarily bring virtuous conduct or any conduct. It is about knowing, presenting, engaging, a lot of other verbs come in. Okay? And this comes up many times, and I'm with Gil right now. Only Gil can come up with a course title, makes me stop and think and remember. It is ethics, equivalence of ethics and enlightenment. Okay. And he starts off with this particular sutta: where there is virtuous conduct, there is wisdom. Where there is wisdom, there is virtuous conduct. This comes from Chaitanya Karaniya Sutta in Anguttara Nikaya. That's basically where it starts from. And it goes on to say how the wisdom manifests as, just as an ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, so too Dharma has one taste, taste of liberation, and realization of that is wisdom. So there is an intertwined thing between the notion of wisdom and the notion of Buddhist teachings of Dharma in the same line. So in a way, Buddhism in the academic circles or scholarly circles, I've seen it referred to as a wisdom tradition with an emphasis on attaining transformative understandings and insights. The path we are on is on the insight tradition. We have San Jose insight meditation. This is tied to early Buddhist practice, which is approximately 200 to 400 years after the passing of the Buddha. That's when the canon came together, and that's all teachings that the insight tradition largely is based out of. And the distinction to conventional wisdom and the Buddhist wisdom, and elements of it, I should say, is understanding the difference between the head knowledge and heart wisdom. We're going to unpack this a little bit more. What does it mean by head knowledge versus heart wisdom? How it plays out? Is being ethical purely a cerebral activity, or is it a heartfelt activity? And we will unpack some of this. So I want to broaden the scope of the rest of my talk into two large topics. What are the foundations of this wisdom that Buddha taught? And how do we cultivate it? What and how? So in the foundations of wisdom taught, there are three components to it. One is, what exactly are the teachings? Second is distinguishing wisdom from knowledge. For a long time, they were interchangeable terms for me. It takes the discernment had quite a bit of reflection and contemplation for me to understand the discernment between wisdom and knowledge. And the third one, more importantly, is what does a lived experience of a wisdom look like? Let's go into some detail on each one of them. In the teachings, if you look at all of Buddhism, what we call the elephant footprint or the major teaching, the basis is the Four Noble Truths. Everything fits into that. And the fourth noble truth is the path is defined as the Eightfold Path. The first noble truth is suffering exists. Second noble truth is reason for suffering is clinging. Third noble truth is you can end suffering by ending clinging, letting go of clinging. And the way to let go of clinging is the Eightfold Path. So in the Eightfold Path, they're packaged into three subtitles. There's ethical steps, concentration steps, and the wisdom steps. In the ethical steps are the right speech, right action, right livelihood. We won't go into the detail right now. In the concentration or mental discipline, we talk about right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So what's in the wisdom steps? Right view and right intention. We talked about right view, Kalyanamitta, last week, right? And the most succinct way Buddha explains right view is to see the reality as is in the context of Four Noble Truths. That is a required element of understanding what the wisdom is in Buddhist sense, at least the way Buddha taught. What that really means is, and actually there are two things. One is Four Noble Truths, and the other one is what's called three characteristics, which Buddha asked repeatedly to use that as a lens, and the three characteristics being impermanence, suffering, and not self. And it translates to look at the transient nature of all phenomena, fleeting nature of all phenomena in everything that we see, impermanence. And there is, who is the person, who is the one observing that, the seer, the self? It's not a permanent entity, that's a fleeting entity as well. We form a role for that particular transaction, for that particular thing, and we bring certain tendencies or knowledge or conditionality uniquely for that role. And when you take a different role, you take a different set of conditionality, different tendencies as appropriate for the role. I'm only simplifying the not-self definition, but that he wants us to look through phenomena from the point of not stickiness of, I am real, my ideas are real, my views are authentic, I, me, myself. He wants to have a much looser grip on that and notice the relative aspect or the transient aspect of the self. Yeah. So I went through this exercise once and I wrote down all my identities that contribute to a function. I'm an immigrant, right? I'm an engineer, I'm a chaplain, and every one of them as my identity, I take at a different time. I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm all of this stuff, right? So each one of them has its own set of conditionality, beliefs, all of the stuff. So they come together in one role I take. So when I go home to my wife, this is not the tone with which I talk. She'll slap me. It won't work, right? This is a different role I have taken that's appropriate for this function, right? So that's one way, if you want to only look at it, how we form the self for a given situation and go on and follow this. He wants to understand the wisdom through that lens as well. The second is distinguishing wisdom from knowledge. And how often have you heard, he's knowledgeable, he's quite wise. She's knowledgeable, she's quite wise, right? And the difference, the way it is taught here is knowledge gathers information, wisdom transforms perception. Knowledge gathers information, wisdom transforms perception. So what does it mean? Knowledge answers what and how very clearly. Wisdom answers why and what truly matters. What does it matter? And that's a wisdom question, right? So in a general sense, the way if I say how I normally act is I know something, I perceive something, and I act on it. Those are my general tendencies, right? And the Buddhist notion of wisdom says, when you know something, when you perceive something, stop, pause, and apply wisdom. Don't act before taking that pause. In all of our meditation practice, we are working on cultivating that pause. Okay. In the science of mindfulness, they analyzed Buddhist teaching and went through the science lens. And this is what they came up with as a simple example to illustrate. When we hear sudden noise outside, there are sensations. For me, normally it's a tightening of the chest somewhere here. Oh my God, something blew up. All right. And what it happens invariably, what they tell you is it triggers an emotion. It could be anxiety, fear, whatever it may be. And the time between that emotion of anger, anxiety, whatever it is, to the time it constructs a thought is a fraction of a second. And what they said, in the thoughts immediately, they put the electrodes to the head and looked at the prefrontal cortex and managed it. And they basically said, thoughts rapidly construct stories. And we believe the stories and we act on them. So emotion triggering thoughts, thoughts constructing stories, stories selling us, believe it or not, this is real, this is real, this is real. And then we act on that. And this is, it all can happen in a second or less, or a couple of seconds. What we are trying to do is, when we are cultivating the wisdom, we are trying to not miss out that felt sensation of the body. Wait a second, what is it? Is it a balloon pop? Or is it really something to be concerned of? Right? So we are essentially cultivating the pause or a gap, not to take the default mode network and take through the thought process, but applying, inserting the wisdom. There in itself is a subtle difference, significant yet subtle, between the acquisition of knowledge versus cultivating wisdom. So this distinction of understanding, so this is why I don't see much of know as a verb in Buddhist texts. I see cultivate, I see abide, I see develop, all kinds of stuff. And there's nothing that tells me just know. And this is one of the things that Suzuki Roshi, who wrote the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, highly, highly, highly recommend the book. Did I say highly? Right. And that book you can read three times and you get three entirely three different insights. And he went the other way around. What does it take to empty our mind so that we are like that two-year-old child with curiosity? You get more wisdom when you are more open and curious than to be judgmental and comparing and relating to what you already know. So the third part of applying wisdom, there is a methodology that Buddha taught, right? Obviously, the underpinning to all of these behaviors is our precepts, non-harming, looking at the consequences, all of the law, right? Non-harming, not stealing, not speaking in a friendly, not friendly tone, or not abusing sexuality, or not getting intoxicated, the five precepts that we know, right? But in fact, as a wisdom test, Buddha gave a five-part filter, five-part checklist. Is when the pause happens, when we are analyzing after the perception is it wholesome or unwholesome? Is it blameworthy or blameless? Is it criticized by wise or praised by wise? Does it lead to harm? Or does it lead to welfare for one and all, right? Does it lead to suffering or does it lead to happiness? These five filters between perception and action are what the wise people do. That is applying the wisdom in our day-to-day life. Formulaic, yeah. But before we get to the list, we need to cultivate that time. And meditation is the proven way to give that pause. It slows us down, or it's for our betterment, right? And I work in jail, right? And impulse is the one of the main reasons more than half the people are there. Impulse. And if you take reasons as anger, lust, and addiction, and you strike them as not offenses, everybody would be out. Those three things are the reason 90% of the people are hooked up. And there's another angle to it. Only 10% of the people, from what I counted, are there because they are incarcerated with no bail. Other 90% of the people are there because they can't afford the bail or they can't afford the attorney. But they are there for the, they are generally good people. I have a great relationship with many of them. It is that impulse. often they have a huge realization as they attend my meditation classes and look at all this stuff, and they have a sense. And when I, particularly when I teach Brahma Viharas, I'd be amazed. You'd be amazed how often people come to me and say, "Chaturanga, can I talk to you?" I said, "Yes, yeah. I want to ask forgiveness for my wife. How do I do that?" This, you know, you don't need to teach them explicitly. Take them through the practice. Just give them an opportunity. Let it unfold. Right? And that's how Buddha's teaching, in a sense, let wisdom unfold through this way. Wisdom as a lived experience, basically, it summarizes as true wisdom is not intellectual but relational. It changes how we see ourselves and how it connects us to others. That takes the energy out of our self-rumination or self-thought and allows us to exist in the context of something larger than ourselves. And if I'm not pausing and thinking and reflecting, this thought never used to come naturally from me, at least. Mutual benefit and consideration. Anytime there is a mutual benefit and consideration that's brought into this reflection, compassion naturally unfolds. Compassion grows. Compassion is not something I can say at 11 a.m. Thursday, Ram's going to be compassionate. It doesn't work that way, right? It has to flow. It has to arise. And we are creating conditions for it to arise. And I can only have that condition when I have relatability to those who are suffering and have a contextual connection and see the oneness or interconnectedness with the people who are out there. And one of the most interesting things, I wrote it down, I didn't know down which teacher said that. When Buddha got awakened in the Bodhi tree, he emphasized that he didn't discover anything new, but he saw something without distortion. So it's what the teacher said. He didn't stand up and scream, "Eureka, I found it." But what he said is, "I can see very clearly now. And this is why I know the effects of Mara. And he's no longer has any hold on me." So in a way, I feel like this practice is more of a subtraction than addition. We are subtracting our tendencies, how we think, defaults, and all the stuff. And when you're left with it, is clarity of seeing as it is. And vipassana, the word, is literally means clear seeing. So cultivating this wisdom, one is the practice. Talk briefly about that, and then we talk about the understanding the barriers to wisdom, what holds us back from cultivating wisdom. The three steps again, what I thought this part is how guilt taught me part of it. Okay, how do you cultivate wisdom? And there are some actual text words also, I will mix them together. One is listening and learning through scriptures and talks. And the Pali word for is sutta mayapanya, which means you're cultivating wisdom through the suttas. Wisdom of learning and understanding scriptures. And this also involves listening deeply and understanding in a sangha environment. What are others' experiences? I don't need to debate that or discuss that or this, but I need to appreciate that. Right? Their experience is true. Right? And Buddhism places a lot of emphasis on experience, particularly once you get to clear seeing. There's a beautiful sutta called Kallama Sutta, Kalama. If you can remember, you can go Google it, and there are many, many, many commentaries on that. In that sutta, Buddha lays out, please, Kalamas, and he lists 10 things. Don't go by oral transmission. Don't go by lineage. Don't go by testament. Don't go by canonical authority. Don't rely on logic. Don't rely on inference. Don't go by recent contemplation. Don't go by the acceptance or a view of a tradition or a convention. Don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic or the teacher is an ultimate authority. And he said, go by your direct experience of clearly seeing, and see your own thoughts and actions are wholesome. I can't imagine any religion saying that. Right? In every religion, there is a book that is the authority. There's a scripture that is authority. Here in Kalama Sutta, and he just lays out how important is clear seeing and cultivating our experience as a result of that. And in that path is where we absorb and allow everyone's experience as a valid experience. I don't need to debate it. I don't need to discuss it. I don't need to criticize it. I can appreciate it. And that is an element of cultivating the wisdom. The second one he calls it Chintamaya Panya, which is cultivating through deep reflection and inquiry. What is truly happening now? We gravitate towards our suffering and try to construct a narrative in relation to that suffering. That's our tendency. And if you stop and think, there is more to it than what we perceive as the truth. And this is where this Chintamaya Panya, or reflection of inquiry and questioning, is a very difficult exercise on certain events. And Buddha said multiple times, if you look through the lens of old age, disease, and death. In fact, when that story that most of you may know, Mary brought a young son who is dead to Buddha and said, I want my son. My son is dead. She's wailing. I'm suffering. Yeah, Buddha consoled her and also said, all right, here is a riddle for you, or here is, go around the town and pick a mustard seed from any house who hasn't suffered a death. It sounds harsh to console someone grieving over a loss, but he wanted to send a message that death is as inevitable as life itself. That's why one Buddhist joked, when you see a big banner, God saves everything. No, God saves, God doesn't save anyone. The best he can do is prolong death. Right? So there's a pragmatism of how Buddhist teaching manifests is something to be thought of. And the third one, which is contemplative a little bit, is called Bhavanamaya Chitta, or Bhavanamaya Panya, which is cultivating wisdom through meditation. And this meditation path is very sacred for Western Buddhists, because we all started into Buddhism from meditation. And this is only true in Western Buddhism, right? And the notion of generosity, what we talked about, your notion of service, serving the teachers, serving the sanghas, all that stuff, prerequisites in Thai tradition, Burmese tradition, and others, Sri Lankan tradition, is all put aside for us. And we started first with meditation in our practice. So those were the three steps he gave. Now, in the interest of time, the barriers to meditation really comes down to one thing, largely. It is habitual reactivity. How often do we stop and think, where did I get that thought from? Why should I pursue this line of thinking? Is there a wiser way to look at it? And unless you are into spiritual path, you probably never heard, at least I have not, generally in the language, heard the word deluded enough times. We use that word a lot in the scriptural sense. That is delusion. And the delusion, in a sense, in Buddhist teaching, is a habitual reactivity, which means we are not applying all of our wisdom to the situation. We're just yielding to reactive nature of our thoughts and minds. And the second barrier is holding self as a reference. I, me, myself. That's not how I see it. There's I there that forms and that becomes very strong. It's okay to have that, but it's important to question that. Pick to use an identity-based thinking, I am right. Only that, I am right, you are wrong. We are living in that world right now. And fourth one he calls is emotional turbulence, clouding perception through fear, anger, and pride. They all put a coating on the perception that prevents us from seeing things as they are. This is what he calls it as the barriers to wisdom. So in closing, I want to give three elements of distinguishing between conventional wisdom and the Buddhist Parami definition of wisdom, right? One is the scope of understanding. Let's use that as a criteria. In the conventional wisdom, when I look at the dictionary and Wikipedia and others, it generally came out to definition of a wisdom is includes insight into human nature, pragmatic expertise, long-term consequences of actions in complex situations. That's the dictionary slash Wikipedia definition of what a conventional wisdom is. In the Buddhist Parami definition of wisdom, it specifically focuses on understanding the core Buddhist truths, the four noble truths, and three characteristics of existence, that is impermanence, suffering, and not self. It is an insight into reality, not just an accumulation of facts. That's the distinction between the scope, how conventional wisdom is taught, how Buddhist wisdom is asked to look at. The second is the criteria is connection to action. What we are now. In the conventional wisdom, a wise person's actions are guided by practical judgment and ethical principles. That's how we use the word. In the Buddhist definition of parami as a perfection, a wise person's actions are driven by this transcendent insight. It leads to compassionate action and renunciation. The word compassion that's come out of virtuous thinking is an outcome that is implicit of an action for a wise person, according to Buddhism. And I didn't see the word compassion anywhere in any definition in the conventional wisdom side, just to draw the distinction. Third is the cultivation process. How do we get there? You cultivate conventional wisdom primarily through life experiences, observation, reflection, and intellectual learning. These are not my words. This is how I Googled and found out from different sources and put them together. In Buddhist Parami definition, the cultivation process arises from disciplined practice of paramis like generosity, morality, and meditation. It is not an intellectual exercise alone. And I want to end with the Samiddhi Sutta, which beautifully summarizes all of this, what I just shared. It simply reads, wisdom is purified by virtuous conduct is purified by wisdom, where one is, the other is. The person with virtuous conduct has wisdom, and the wise person behaves virtuously. The combination of virtuous conduct and wisdom is called the highest thing in the world. Dignity of 4.22. May we see clearly, may we see wisely, may we serve with understanding and compassion. Thank you. We have a few minutes for Q&A.
I'm not sure if it's necessarily a question, but more or less an observation. But the person that kind of came to mind when wisdom is not intellectual but relational, and you know, we let wisdom unfold. The first one that kind of came to mind is parenting tactics.
Sorry? Parenting tactics.
In the sense that I've noticed that, like, for example, like in my parents, whenever I would make a mistake, they would guilt me or shame me for making the mistake instead of allowing me to simply experience the mistake and see the repercussions that come with it. And I can see how not allowing me to simply experience the mistake has had intense repercussions in how I go about in my day. So like I'm so afraid of making mistakes, I'm so afraid of saying the wrong thing, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of simply allowing me to be like, it's okay, honey, you learned your lesson. That's okay.
That's a beautiful way to look at it. Thank you for having that. Yeah. We can learn best by ourselves. And that's why I love the word allow. And we think about the word tolerate or accept. I prefer the word allow than tolerate or accept. Allow has no conditions. So there is no such thing called perfection in our daily life. Everything is a lived experience, an opportunity to learn and grow. And we are all capable of, if our environment allowed it, it's easy for us to flourish in that. And I've seen many, many people right now in different facets because of the top-down parental thing, to use the phrase. People talk about, I ended up being silent all the way till I got traumatized. The spectrum of reactions, you see, because of that. Yeah, but you summarized our society issues succinctly there. Thank you. On the Zoom, anyone?
Thanks for that great talk. What when you're talking about wisdom is in virtue, together reminds me of Socrates, who was a big believer of how virtue and wisdom were so inseparable. I just thought it was so interesting that those terms were so similar in such completely different cultures. Thanks. I love that talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. This is all the byproduct of how much reflection this Socrates or Buddha went through, right? For these insights to arise, suddenly they contemplated quite a bit.
Great talk. It's a great talk. Usually most of the talks kind of stress me out, but this one was very
Because you're a wise man. You are a wise man.
We all are. really, really, it hit. And you know, you were talking about how, first of all, thanks, you know, for service you provide people that are in jail. Also, Margaret, I know you volunteer for the jails, and what you talked about, and what Juan also, you know, is, you know, their reaction, but you know, it's a lot of it is trauma and how they are triggered by that trauma and how, you know, they snap because of all these things that are bottled up inside. And I think all of us experience this through life, and we all have our trigger points, and you know, through meditation and calming the mind and the body, you know, you get to start, you know, pulling these things apart. And by wisdom, I didn't start reading until I was in my late 20s. And my wife recommended this book called Road Less Traveled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before that, I would always find reasons to blame why I react this way, mm-hmm. instead of understand the cause and effect of that.
Yeah.
So I think knowledge is important. And if these teachings were done in kindergarten and, you know, it would be such a different society. Yeah, so thank you for the talk.
Oh, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Just triggered a thought in me. I appreciate that a lot. So one other thing that I learned in both in Vedanta studies, more so in Buddhist studies, the way Gill teaches, he makes us write lots of reflections. Okay. So in the current course I'm taking, when I think about, I often write, where did my thought come from? And then I go behind, I realize my deep-rooted conditionality, wherever it came from. And putting it writing is a meditative experience for me. I'm not just sitting and just blanking out. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Is my mom's behavior, my dad's behavior, how my mom treated my dad, or my dad treated my mom? Everything, is that deeper introspection gets to the crux of my conditionality sometimes. Because I'm not as spontaneous as I think I am, because all this baggage is making me respond this way. Right? And it never occurred to me unless this reflection process kicked in. Right? And that chintamayapanya, or contemplation and the reflection part of it, is an important step. And that's why when we hear something great, we get inspired. And then we forget about it, because the reflection process says, I'm here, Ram. This is inspiring. And then how do I get from here to here? That's the path I want to invest the time in, not just by wowed by this and write it as a nice quote in my book. Right? And part of my path is when I write a reflection, and honestly, it's painful exercise sometimes. It's not always intellectual exercise. You go in and touch yourself in areas where I was afraid of going in. And that adds to my path, that adds to my practice, and brings me closer to that oneness. And that's why I have such a deep, I often wonder, does Buddhism has faith or beliefs? I have faith in this path. You just follow the path. It's been good for 2,600 years. I don't need to be skeptical of it. All right, I'll end there. Thank you so much, folks. Really appreciate this.